I'll forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 70th Skin On Podcast. Yes.
Hello.
That has one of those, it sounds like for a second it means something and then you realise it's just...
It's been 6 days, so this is way more frequent than we usually meet up. So what have you watched
compared
the last 6 days? Compared to the last couple.
Yeah, it's true.
Jason.
Okay. I got a couple. I got a couple right here.
He's got a couple. He's got loads. A dozen in the last 2 days.
I've got three, really.
Okay.
I'll start with Hush.
Okay, Hush.
Mike Flanagan, Netflix thriller / horror.
This is about the home invasion of
Person with Death. Yeah, so you can kind of guess what kind of things it does in the context of, you know, walking around a room making noises so we can hear your sex effect. And it does work in that regard. Like, it works very effectively as a kind of home invasion.
This is essentially Wait Until Dark, but with deafness instead of blind.
Yeah,
right?
Essentially. And
I'll take that.
It doesn't spin out too long. It's fine. It's essentially a two-hander.
Hmm.
And both of them are fine. With a couple of other bits thrown in.
Both of them.
A couple of times it kind of slips off course a bit. But, it's a harmless and decent enough 90 minutes. Like, it's on your local Netflix. Fire it up and watch it.
It sounds like Get In, Get Out does the job.
Yeah, sorry, but I can't go wrong.
Good.
It's actually three kind of thriller horror kind of films actually this weekend, I realised. The Invitation. This is good.
Surprised.
Well, I'm never really optimistic when it comes to kind of anything in the horror kind of
I've noticed it.
Well, for the most part, it's terrible. I've watched too many bad films, I guess, so your expectation is lower. Maybe.
Later, we'll be talking about Friend Request.
Yeah, indeed.
Anyway.
But The Invitation, I liked it a lot. It does that rare thing in horror that nobody bothers to do anymore. Characterization and slow build-up. So when something actually happens, you care for what's on screen, which raises the stakes a little higher considerably. Why don't people do that very often anymore?
I don't know. I think they do, but I think it's more along. I don't think it's more along sort of the fringe edge of the horror genre.
But I think this is more because it doesn't go. It doesn't chase the quick bang scares either. Yeah, the jump scares are largely absent here. Yeah.
Good.
But like it's an effective drama that tips a different way more than the kind of classically structured horror film. But it works really, really well. And as I said, the characters are great and the direction is really good. They know what they're doing here. There's a lot of control in what's being put on the screen. And
that is good to hear because this is, I think, you have to call it a career resurrection for Carrie Sama. She made, prior to this, her last big film was Jennifer's Body, which is back in 2009.
I had seen that. Did she make Girl Fight?
She made Girl Fight. Which I liked. Between those two, she made Aeon Flux.
That's
one way.
Shalise, they're on MTV superhero films.
I like the idea that Jennifer's Body is actually good in that run. Jennifer's Body is terrible.
Is it?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
It's polarizing. I haven't seen it myself.
No.
But it's not. Diablo
Cody, isn't it?
This is well worth getting hold of and seeing. It's good. And it is a bit of a career renaissance, as you said, Phil.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
And it seems to be getting pretty favourable reviews across the board as well, which is good to see.
And a good, solid psychological horror thriller thing.
Yeah.
I'm always for that.
Yeah, I recommend it. My last one, which I'd never seen, but I think we've discussed before, because you guys have seen it, I think liked it more than I did. Let Me In.
I like Let Me In.
It was in my top 25 that year.
Oh, lads. Right, okay.
Let Me In is
the remake of The Right One. There's nothing essentially wrong with Let Me In. It's fine. It's really well shot. Looks really great. There's these kind of muted browns and kind of grisly dirt under the snow, but in darkness there's a blood, you know, that kind of thing going on. Really well cast. Great cast.
Moretz and McPhee. And Jenkins.
Elias Cotes. And Richard Jenkins, you can't really go wrong. You really can't. So, no problem there. I watched it, and for the most part, I watched it fine. Like, But it's missing something. There's something in the DNA in the original that's not in this. And it's the associated tone and slight weirdness and oddness that the original has that this doesn't.
Yeah, it's a bit more polished.
Yeah, and it's a little too polished for me. And in that regard, I wonder why this needs to exist.
Because American audiences don't accept
that. Other than that, there's no other reason for it. it doesn't do anything better than the original does, in my opinion. So whilst it's okay in and of itself, and if the original didn't exist, this would be very serviceable film to watch.
But I mean, like that's the logic behind the vast majority of English
language
remakes.
Yeah, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
That's the logic. But some remakes, I guess, in English language can be better.
Oh, yeah, well,
it's like if you do a cover of a song. If you do a cover of a song the exact same way that the original singer did it, what is the point? If you're not doing something with the song, why are you covering it? And I would say, the Girl with Dragon Tattoo, the original, despite people's kind of talk about it, is not particularly great.
It's,
I think Fincher improves it.
Yeah.
I think it's shot better. I personally think Rooney Mara is better than Peter Pace in the original. And so I think Fincher was, and the source material for both is a problem anyway in that regard.
Yeah.
But I think Fincher gets more out of it than
Fincher's a better director.
But my point is, if you're remaking something,
do something different.
Like, you know,
I don't think anybody sits down when they're doing a remake and says, I'm going to make it perfectly adequate.
But I can sit down and say, I'm sorry, there's this film here, there's this film here, I really like this film here, I thought this was a bit meh. So I'm saying, what's the point of this?
Yeah. Okay.
So I think is legitimate.
I think the response, unfortunately, to be cynical, will be, you know, this made more money at the box office because people didn't have to read it. People don't like to read
that.
Films.
Yeah, but money's
that
money.
Is
that means nothing to me.
I know. That
means
I'm
going to sit here after watching it.
I know.
But I think, let me in. You see, the problem is, especially when you talk about a remake, you have to talk about the original. And you let the right one in. I like both very much. But they both have their pluses and they both have their problems too.
Agreed. I'm not saying Event Raven is perfect either.
No, which is
a touch overpraised at the time of the game.
I agree.
That.
And I see now. I've never really given much thought. I didn't write about. I've never reviewed either film, so now you're kind of putting me on the spot.
For the most part, people like it, the remake a lot. So I'm not. I'm aware. I'm in the minority in this one.
No. I mean, I get it. I'd actually have to rewatch them, or at least let me in.
Rewatch them both, but
back to back.
Back to back. Yeah.
Or actually on two monitors side by side.
One eye on each, chameleon style.
Yeah. The man of filter.
But again, you have the language. You close one eye and watch whichever one you prefer.
Jean-Luc Godard presents a vampiric experiment.
You can kind of do that with the Gus Van Sant cycle on your.
No. That is among the most redundant of remakes.
But I think that
An interesting point in that. That was the point of that film.
Yeah.
But you do make an interesting point.
Like screen and screen.
Well, there is one significant and unnecessary difference.
Vince Vaughn.
You
got Anthony Perkins here. You got Vince Vaughn.
That's probably color, right?
No. There is an additional scene. There's one additional.
Voyeuristic.
Yeah.
Where he goes to the what they couldn't show in 1960.
Yeah. That is very unpleasant.
What they didn't need to show in 1960.
Exactly. That's a very fair point.
So I mean, that's what I think takes away from the whole argument of it as an art film or as an experimental art film.
It's an experiment purely for Van Sant and perhaps for Christopher Doyle, who's about the only person who gets away from that film with the dignity intact, because the colours in that thing are gorgeous.
I quite like Anne Hesh.
She's not.
But I quite like anyway.
I suppose.
Not much of a part. Anyway, yeah. Anyway, that's a remakes of a general conversation probably for another time. But
we could do a whole podcast extra.
We certainly could.
We must do one of those sometime.
Indeed, surprise the hell out of people.
Probably not today.
If you're going to go with the ones who went back and did their own work over again. So like Hitchcock with Haneke is a perfect example. Hitchcock with The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah.
Haneke gets funny games like, oh, here it is, but. Just, I'm not sure American audiences get the point. Let's remake it. And
they still didn't get the point.
Yeah, plus it's an inferior film.
Well, it is, but only... Is that because
the
we see the original?
I don't think there's wrong with the American remake.
No, there is nothing wrong, but the impact of it does derive at least from the fact that it's delivering a message to a foreign audience in a foreign language.
Yeah,
because it's very, very much primarily... going up against ideas of American cinema. That's what it's all about.
Sure. And plus, it's when you remake something you show in America, I think it's the American audience and their kind of complicit thing in violence and you know, Gun Control, all that kind of stuff, is you can really push that at them in English language. Yeah.
If you do it in German as they did in the original, it's all the more confrontational.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all the more. I'll never forget the first time I watched it. I watched it on my own. I watched it on a laptop, and I was actually traumatized. It's
something
brilliant.
Else.
Is there any then that you would think where David Greenidge is better?
The director's own work.
Yeah, because I'm going to go for Takahashi Shimizu, who did Ju-on and The Grudge, and I would say that The Grudge, the American one, is more enjoyable. It's better.
For the most part, inferior ones. I remember. Come to my mind, the remake of George Sluzer's
The Vanishing. That is a prime example of how not to do it.
Yeah, it is.
You don't imagine he did that to his own material.
No. Well, no, but it,
no, the script's a problem there. The ending is completely changed.
Well, that's it. It's like, let's take this, and it's like we were discussing the Verhoeven. I was talking about the Verhoeven remakes with somebody there. And the idea is you take something that succeeded or gained a cult following because it's not a cookie-cutter conventional film, and your first response on remaking it is, let's fashion it into a cookie-cutter.
It doesn't fit.
No
argument with that. Well, that's me.
Cool. So I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey.
We all did.
Scan-on field trip.
Mine was Jason that night. So.
Yeah, but I did see it day before, as I mentioned last week. So we've all...
Yes, we have all partaken in this, the splendor of 2001 on 70mm.
And it's beautiful.
It's astounding.
Beautiful. The print is fantastic.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it holds up amazing. And it's amazing.
It's brand new, though, the print, so, so that helps.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't hurt.
Yeah. It's amazing to look at it and to see... And again, having seen it before, obviously. But you're always reminded when you watch it of just how much absolutely everything has borrowed from it.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
The whole swathes of cinema owe it themselves to it.
And you're like,
it stands on the cinematic landscape like a giant monolith that all the apes are looking up at. That's an ape impression.
Sorry,
I would also go with Event Horizon, Alien.
That's everything.
The Christopher Nolan's entire filmography.
Gaspar Noé owes a huge amount to 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, well, he only watched the last 10 minutes, though, in fairness.
True. I love
Noé.
I will not have any argument.
That is not a bad approach. But it's beautiful. And I was amazed on rewatching it. How Kubrick sort of captures... It's all beautiful. It's all beautifully shot. It all looks fantastic. But sort of the mundanity of the future.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of...
The foods, routine of it.
The foods.
The foods. And you're flying through space and you're watching in-flight entertainment. Yeah. You know?
The Skype call, essentially, was...
The airplane, too, also had that.
Yeah. Which you borrow from 2001.
Yeah. And things like the Hilton on the space wheel.
Or flying Pan Am into space.
Yeah.
Little things.
Little things like that. And then there's... And all the signage, actually. So there's an amazing amount. It just sort of took me as I was watching it, the amount of attention that Kubrick paid.
Yeah, you put up on Twitter some of the pictures. It's great, some of the stuff. That you used the bathroom in space and stuff.
Yeah, like there's a moment where one of the characters pauses to read instructions for a zero-G toilet. Or, you know, when the pod bay doors, it has pod bay door closes, it has like the caution written on
the explosive door.
Three times you see that, so he is very much telegraphing that that is going to be important.
That's the old rule. You show a gun in the first act, you better have it going off by the start of the third.
Yeah.
And the thing I found fascinating about it, and still looks astonishing, is the walking angles and running angles. The walk to the stairs and around and into the...
It's technology that's been used before and since.
Still think
and
it's
still a great effect.
But it really is a great effect.
Yeah.
That and the... What I had forgotten about the film was how long the ape sequence was. I had forgotten that...
It's an entire first act. Which is astounding.
It's a beautiful little... film in
it. And yet, at the same time, the genius of Kubrick to take pretty much all of human evolution and reduce it to one cut. Up goes the bone,
In fairness, on the other hand, the genius of Kubrick to suggest the moment that mankind came into existence was the point we discovered to beat each other with bones. That is the moment of human civilization there.
I would probably agree with that. Yeah. And... Like, he wasn't the cheeriest of people. I think his worldview was clear for all to see.
He's more going that the dawn of man was when we decided to use tools, but then...
mechanized those bad boys,
We decided that tools work pretty well for bashing each other's skulls in.
Yeah.
What else do you use tools for? I have a...
This is how Phil came to be on the podcast.
I've seen more films with baseball bats and beaten somebody up than I have played baseball.
You are a Scorsese fan.
Yeah, well, that's true.
But I mean, that was one of the questions. I remember somebody pointing that out to me and asking me a little while ago, why in the world Irish sports stores sell baseball bats?
It's like home invasion, two words, man.
Right next to the balaclavas, you know, for your swag holiday. Bag. Yeah.
I was going to go with one word, rounders, but okay.
Nah, we use tennis rackets for that.
Obviously, you're not hardcore enough.
Yeah. We're older.
Can I be honest, though? I appreciate Stanley Kubrick as a filmmaker. I think he's amazing. Fantastic visualist, but he's always sort of left me a bit cold.
Not the only one.
You're not going to get emotion from Kubrick. Yeah. The closest you're going to get is the bond between mother and son as they flee from the father who is chasing them with an axe. Yeah.
I would argue there's some moving moments and sequences in Barry Lyndon, but aside from that, you really
are. But that's the only time that he ever really went for drama, because he never got to do the great job.
I saw Barry Lyndon in 70mm 5 years back, and like whatever about 2001 made a treat, this is astonishing.
But I mean, all his films are beautiful, and I am not in any way diminishing his contribution to cinema, which is astounding.
He's a director that's comfortable in all genres. He's comfortable in horror, he's comfortable in sci-fi, he's comfortable in drama, he's comfortable in comedy.
But he is a cult filmmaker. Yeah, right. I would argue that same with the Coen Brothers would be, not in the same way, but I think they're very cult filmmakers. They're very detached.
Their humor. Fargo, they're actually physically cult filmmakers.
Yeah, but even if Fargo in particular is quite mean. But Fargo, like they're almost mean filmmakers.
With the exception of Raising Arizona, all their comedy is black.
Yeah,
it's dark.
Yeah,
they look at the bleakness of the world. And they're happy to laugh at.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think Fargo again. You're meant to sympathise with Gunderson.
Yeah, she saves. She's a
fundamental pinnacle of goodness in the world, in that white plateau of just vast human indecency and stuff.
Yeah,
again, and I think that's fair. I'm not sure Kubrick really has that
because he doesn't believe one exists.
Yeah,
maybe.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not that his films don't have a moral centre. It's that they don't necessarily need one.
Yeah. No.
I think they reflect how he sees the world.
Yeah.
In very real terms. And you know, I think I like him so much because I probably see the world the same way. So I'm serious. I know it comes as a shock to you, but as I've got older, I maybe don't put him as high a level as I would have when I was younger.
But I still
cannot but appreciate his influence on cinema.
Other than that sort of cool detachment and the visual aesthetic, is there something that you can say that is, you know, typifies Kubrickian cinema?
Primeval sense of
wrongness with humanity.
It doesn't matter what era or what.
It manifests itself somewhere in it. Yeah, it's in the DNA. It's in the blueprint of the film.
Yeah, it's whether it's in. Whether it's in the sweep of a historical drama, whether in a space-driven future, or whether in
Cold
here and now
comedy.
In the disintegration of a marriage, as in Eyes Wide Shut,
it's there.
It's there.
It's always there. It's
a lingering withering of humanity.
To stretch a metaphor, it's the black staring of Lesk object.
Or the cold eye of hell. I mean, is it kind of...
Yeah.
Hal is an extraordinary creation.
Hal is not only the ultimate Kubrickian character.
Yeah.
He is,
because he's not real.
He is the greatest nemesis in any film I can think of.
Yeah, probably right.
And here's the thing, right? So when I was watching Space Odyssey and looking at Hal, I was actually thinking again, and this is the Kubrickian irony of it, is that Hal is ironically at one stage the most inhuman of characters, but also the most human of characters. He's the one. In 2001, Space Odyssey, who actually feels like a person, albeit a psychotic.
Well, yeah, but he's the one that ends up feeling pain. He's the one that ends up feeling
and expressing a will to survive.
Yeah.
The
so in that cold,
the most animalistic thing of the lot, he wants to survive, which is
so
quite
in that
and powerless to stop his own demise at a certain point.
Yeah,
and then it's begging.
Yeah, and singing.
And begging. I'm sorry, Dave. And it gets progressively more desperate. It's actually quite.
It is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
The voice changes.
It's an extraordinary film.
And there's your Kubrickian comedy, you know, commentary. The fact that the most human character in the entire film is a psychotic computer.
And I would say as well, actually, there's not an insignificant amount of people are not huge fans of 2001. That leaves them cold, and they just don't particularly like it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's very many people that could say its influence, scope, and ambition are unmatched, almost unmatched in historical.
I really like
Citizen Kane. You know,
it's that level. I think it is that. I think absolutely right.
Yeah, and as far as Kubrick films go, it's probably my second favorite. It's probably one of the few that I would actually eagerly watch. Oddly enough, because I'm the populist of the group,
my favorite
is The Shining.
It's probably mine as well.
Doctor Strange Love.
Yeah,
that's 2001 Doctor Strange.
2001, and probably Far Away Buried in there. But I love them all pretty much. Yeah. Anyway,
but gentlemen, let's not fight in here about this. This isn't the podcast room.
So no, I think we sort of went on long enough about that. Yeah. Phil.
Okay, me. It's all about me. Okay, just two I'm going to mention quickly. Because, you know, I'm sure we're all very excited about a new Richard Linklater coming out soon.
Everybody wants some film.
Do they?
I waited all my boyhood for it. Sorry. That's
such a slacker.
I want a different kind of Bernie, but you know.
Sorry,
I'm a bit dazed and confused by this conversation.
Well, that's what I rewatched at the weekend. Dazed and confused.
Good as you remember?
Yeah, pretty much. It's not my favourite of his, but...
Mine neither. Though I do like it.
It is... probably the most Linklater of his films, because always concerned with the characters, not the plot, always keeping it within a relative time span. This all takes place for one day, and it's the fact that it focuses on high school students. It is the last day of school, but you know they're not graduating, they're not going on to college or anything like that.
They're going to get their ass kicked, is what they're
going to
get.
That's all they're going to get. And they're going to go home from school, they're going to go out, they're going to have some beer, they're going to
meet girls
and all that kind of thing. But it's so immersive, and the characters are just so relatable and generally quite pleasant.
And it's a superb last scene, final scene. And I really like it. It's a lovely little capper.
It is. And also, watching it now through the hindsight, which is also 2020, and watching these great actors who suddenly pop up. Hey, there's Matthew McConaughey. Hey, look, Spock the Boozer.
All right. And that's where it started.
And it's still going. And he's milked it. Well done him. It's a joy. It is a real joy. And
I've always liked it. I've always warmed to it. It's quite a warm film. Linklater, in most times, is a warm filmmaker anyway.
That's because
we're talking about contrasts here, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. Generally speaking, there's darkness there, but it's...
it's always about the characters and just what their wants and their travails, and nowhere is that more clear than in this one, I think.
Yeah.
And then completely shifting away from that, something that's very plot driven, rather cold, and I know this. I don't know if we've mentioned it here before, but I know this is probably getting a mixed reaction here. I finally watched Cold in July.
I wasn't a fan. It was okay. I didn't love it, and I'll tell you why. But go on. Niall, you look perplexed.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
They didn't read much for me.
I dig it. Okay. It's it's a tricky one, actually. Trickier than I expected, because you're going in expecting, basic plot. Michael C. Hall spooks an intruder in his house, shoots him dead, and you think, okay, I know where this is going. This is going to be a basic revenge thing with Sam Shepard, the dad of the crook, comes back ostensibly looking for revenge. And then it gets a bit trickier and a bit trickier, and allegiances shift back and forth and back and forth. And I would say it rambles, but the narrative is not its primary concern. It's more about establishing an atmosphere and a look and a time, and I think it does it superbly.
That's where we split up. I felt it postured. I think I felt that it was trying to be, I don't know if any of you read any Jim Thompson.
Oh yeah, like it means big Thompson vibe.
Yeah, and but it's posturing as Thompson as opposed to that immersive feel of it. I never felt that I didn't buy it, I suppose, the only way. It had the cast, had the kind of look.
Yeah.
But it didn't have enough feel for me. And so when I didn't buy it, I didn't buy into the thing. So I was just kind of left kind of cold, a bit meh about it.
Well, I think I might have agreed with you if I didn't. I mean, what I was surprised by is that even though this plot goes on a little bit, and maybe it's a little overstretched in terms of...
his head vigorously.
Yeah, no, it's far too long.
That's not that. I don't.
You left Niall cold in pretty much any month.
I say you could maybe an edit. You could trim maybe 5-10 minutes, and it might be even more effective. But I just thought it rattled along pretty nicely, and I enjoyed it. Now, chances are, if I were to go back and rewatch it, I would start picking apart some flaws. But as is, I thought it enjoyable enough, and you know, I thought it looked great. I think it sounds great.
Did look great.
Cast are pretty damn good.
Yeah,
John Johnson when he rocks it is just brilliant. His introduction.
Don Johnson's great, pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
Well,
give or take, what was that one he made? Shadow of a Doubt? No, it wasn't Shadow of a Doubt. There was one, Beyond a Doubt or Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. There was one horrible legal thriller he did in, like, between...
Some Rebecca de Mornay or something, that era.
It's sort of thing.
The recall is spooking now. This sounds pretty niche.
Well, this is like this is between
Jagged
Miami,
Edge kind of
Miami Vice and Nash Bridges, there. You know. Like this is what
both of which I quite like them. By that.
True, admit, yeah. I would argue Miami Vice is formative and influential.
My peak Don Johnson is Tin Cup.
Yeah, there we go. I can get that.
I love Tin Cup.
I think one part of the cold in July, though, to go back to that, was that I still hadn't forgiven Mike C. Hall for the end of Dexter.
Is it Jim Mickle director?
Yes.
I think I've seen a couple of his films now, and I think I've seen this remake of
We Are What We Are,
which did nothing for me either. I can't get a border as of yet.
Okay. I keep meaning to watch Stakeland, his vampire movie.
It's okay.
I avoided it for the reasons after watching those. I was like, yeah, I don't know.
It's okay.
I might get it.
That one's actually not bad.
It's not great.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's not Zombieland.
So nobody is selling the hell out of Jim Mickle here. Really. Yeah.
I'm just saying I enjoyed it.
It's not the worst thing we've ever seen.
Not going to claim it's any kind of classic, but it's...
No. Okay.
I found it did its job quite efficiently and quite stylishly.
Fair enough.
So in anticipation of Green Room, I rewatched Blue Room.
Jeremy Thorne.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I like it a lot more this time around than I did the last time around. And I liked it quite a lot the last time
we
around.
Enjoyed, I remember we all saw it at JDIF a couple of years back.
Yeah,
and we enjoyed it immensely. I mean, it's a great calling card film.
It is.
It's a great JDIF. I think the first half hour...
The first hour is fantastic.
It doesn't get any better than that.
It is.
But that, even though, like, I think there's issues towards the end and stuff, and it gets a bit ploddy and a bit whatever. But before that, I was on board. Absolutely on board.
Yeah. It's that first half hour. It's when he shaves the beard and it's kind of not as good anymore. But still, up until that point...
Power in the beard.
Yeah,
he's great. He's great. He's like the thinking woman's Charlito Copley.
That's going on the poster.
I want that. Do you think I said that by accident?
Yeah. I say that before he shaved the beard. It's much better. It must be not that last week Philip decided to get rid of his beard and the rest of us still have one. So
I stand by my decision.
Yeah. You look at a young, breezy 27 now.
Nobody noticed.
I didn't even notice the white shaving beard.
I didn't say anything because you had said it on Twitter and you had drawn attention
I meant in real life.
Right, okay.
Don't.
Twitter is real life, Philip. What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. You're trending.
The other thing that I've been watching is not the film, it is TV. I watched the end of The People vs. O.J. Simpson.
It is amazing.
Isn't it fantastic?
That was the best thing Ryan Murphy's ever done in his life.
Well, in fairness, Ryan Murphy did kind of executive produce and kind of produce it, but he didn't.
He directed. He directed a couple of episodes.
Yeah, but this was fully foreign before he came aboard. Like
the writers of The People vs.
People vs. O.J. Simpson is one of the best TV shows I've seen quite so far.
Yes,
if not for Horace Pete, it'll be the best thing I've seen on TV this year.
Interesting.
If you just watch the end credits and they show the people and their original Lance Ito is uncanny.
Oh, isn't he? Isn't he? The whole cast. Oh my god, they're so good.
And the scripting as well.
Yeah.
This is remarkable. We've got 2016 and we have something that could resurrect the careers of Cuba Gooding Jr. and John Travolta in one strand.
David Schwimmer.
Schwimmer's great anyway. Schwimmer's always been great. And
Schwimmer
I've always
has always
said
been
that.
Underrated.
He's the best thing in Friends. He's a straight man against kind of idiocy.
He was for the
first four seasons.
No, I'm going to go with Matthew Perry.
Oh god, great. Schwimmer and then so I hate everybody else.
And somehow Matt LeBlanc was the one who got the spin off.
Yeah, there you go.
Also, I hated Friends.
Well,
anyway,
the problem is that if you brought Matthew Perry back, you had to bring Courtney Cox back, and that was going to be.
All right then.
Anyway.
So that's out there.
I don't like Monica. as a character.
I don't like any of them. All I liked is Ross.
Well, you know that apparently it's back. Like, it's a big thing on streaming service at the moment. 20-somethings who, you know, barely would have been alive on the show. I wouldn't have been
it's
alive on the show.
It's on Comedy Central all the time.
And it's on Netflix.
And it is. And it's massively popular and it's resonating
it's
again.
Terrible.
It's frightening. No, but it's frightening.
Dated. It looks older than Seinfeld. It looks older than I Love Lucy at this stage.
But
it's
the thing is, Seinfeld has barely aged.
I know.
Yeah,
and it's always I love Seinfeld. That's the...
What is the thing with smartphones?
Seinfeld and Frasier at the same time, though. You know, it was like, this is
God,
what an
age.
Day or day,
Jesus,
not.
Aren't they?
And that would have been peak Simpsons as well, right?
Yeah.
Larry Sanders
as well.
Yeah.
Good Lord, we are spoiled.
I've always had an ear for your tongue. Now!
That's
but we were talking about current great television.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the thing. We are living through an era of properly good TV, and...
I think there's so much of great TV as opposed to...
It's impossible to pick.
Great.
And just while we're on the subject of TV very quickly, the Pulitzer Prize this year went for TV criticism to Emily Nussbaum from The New Yorker.
She's great.
And her articles are fantastic.
Yeah.
So,
second year in a row. Wasn't there one last year?
Mary McNamara won last year for the Los Angeles Times. Again, very worth looking up.
Yeah, no, I recommend, if you haven't seen People vs. O.J. Simpson, I recommend watching it. It is...
it's astounding.
It's a film with Cuba, or it's a TV show with Cuba Gooding Jr. that you're just like, my God, he is brilliant.
But it's also a TV show where you know the ending, because that trial has been analyzed so
tension.
Much, but there's so much tension.
Yeah.
There's also...
That didn't stop Titanic getting some of the box office.
What I find amazing about it is the black comedy of it. Like,
it's
horrible, and it's a horrible
thing
that
happens.
Two
defenders watching at points,
And it's also at points, like, there were points where I burst out laughing because it was soul-destroyingly, like, this is literally what it came down to in the end.
If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Yeah.
Sound bites.
Yeah.
And it touched on the whole Kardashian thing. It's extraordinary.
But,
like, it reaches
extraordinary. It couldn't have been me. This is the perfect time for it.
Yeah,
it
is. Yeah,
it shows Johnny Cochran's control of media.
Yeah.
His savvy with that, you know, was quite something.
I haven't seen it, but I've seen a couple of adverts for it, and just like it completely seems to nail down what you guys are describing as far as the characters. There's just one line of Johnny Cochran in the ad where he goes, "I'm not here to be polite, I'm here to win."
Yeah.
I just think, holy crap, I want him as my lawyer if I'm ever indicted for murder.
Yeah.
Or
just
anything.
Saying.
Yeah. Parking ticket.
Yeah.
It's the supporting characters that turn up, and you're just like, oh, there's Bruce Greenwood, I love him.
Oh, Bruce Greenwood should be in everything. I've said this before.
Sarah
Paulson is amazing.
Lord,
she's having a
peak great.
Career.
She's
right
just
now.
Great.
Yeah.
It's great. Also, watch Horace and Pete.
And is it Sterling Brown who is Dardenne?
Yes,
he's really good. He's the breakout.
He's very, very good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very good. Anyway.
So so I recommend that. So we'll move on to the news.
News?
Yes, news of Gleeson's. Because Donald Gleeson seems to be doing everything lately. So Donald Gleeson has signed on to be in Netflix's National Lampoon's origin story, so the story of the
which,
by the
way, I love the way that when they broke this news all over the web, it was like, it was Donald Gleeson to star in Netflix's National Lampoon series, which is very different from what it actually is.
Yeah.
No, it's a futile and stupid gesture, which is the book about the origin of the National Lampoon, the satirical magazine, and he's going to play one of the founders. He's also signed on to play A.A. Milne in an adaptation of the creation of the Winnie the Pooh series. And now he and Brother Breen have signed on for Darren Aronofsky's new film. And it's also got Michelle Pfeiffer, Jennifer Lawrence, and Javier Bardem.
That's a pretty good cast.
That's a
copy
editor's nightmare.
I'm practically sold.
That is an American
there.
Copy editor's nightmare.
Listen, it's Aronofsky. I mean,
how do
I'll
you
spell
Pfeiffer?
what's a donut?
Abdominal? What? Oh, dear.
Yeah, so that's... They're busy boys. Because at the moment, Breen's over in New York at the Tribeca Film Festival with Tiger Raid.
Okay. Which means we get good reviews from our...
Yeah, so that is good news. So, also on the sort of international front, 1 million Dubliners won yesterday in Vegas for the New York Festival World of Film. That's a very complicated title.
New York Festival in Vegas.
You're in New
York,
but not
Film
and
TV
right.
World. It was
but
the
don't worry,
award
we're doing a 100th
was
podcast.
Held in Vegas, and 1 million Dubliners won. a silver medal there, and so that, I mean, that film has been doing really well. It is a fine documentary, so it's great to see that. Closer to home, we're going to get the release of Richard O'Donnell's Atlantic. That's going to be at the end of April, so the 29th of April, and I should be speaking to him very soon.
Yeah, going up against Captain America's Civil War, it's going to be tricky.
Who's going to win? What team are you on?
Team Atlantic.
Team Atlantic.
I didn't catch that at ADIF, unfortunately. It was on ADIF, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I missed it.
It was.
So I hope to catch it when it comes out.
It's still a stellar week for, or stellar the time for Irish cinema, because Sing Street opened there and it opened well. The reviews have been remarkable for it. It's on 98% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, people are only saying that after the reviews for Begin Again, but anyway.
No, but the reviews, it has got universal praise. It is a very enjoyable film, so you can understand why it's doing so well. But it's hard not to like. It's opening in a very slow release, so it's opening with it opened in 5 cinemas, made $69,000, which is it's considerably less than what Once opened to, because Once opened in 2 cinemas, made $60,000.
Wow!
Yeah, so
Once was Once.
Exactly. So
just made a sequel and called it.
But as far as Irish films in America go, Viva's opening at the end of the month, and then next month, Love and Friendship opens as well.
The two of them open
on the same day. Love and Friendship and Lobster.
Campaign for Colin Farrell Best Actor nomination starts here.
And now.
And now.
You heard it here first, people.
Yeah.
So then, the director's Fortnite films were announced for Cannes.
Yes, they were.
So, Philip, I'll hand over to you.
Oh, thank you. I think a lot of people probably looked at the director's Fortnite to see what got in there that didn't get into the main lineup. Sad to say, what did? Well, nice long list. A few debuts in there. There's a great title one. Ma vie de courgette.
My life is a courgette. That's what I read as.
There's also La vie de Therese. So you have
subtitles provided
La
by
La vie de Therese. Is that the sequel to Carol we've all wanted? So that's where you'd be looking for possible nominees for the Camera d'Or for Best First Feature. But also, then, in terms of big names that are in there, a few notable ones. Alejandro Jodorowsky, for one.
Yep.
He's back.
Laura
Poitras's Risk, which is her documentary on Julian Assange.
It's unfortunately not her documentary on the board game Risk, which I would really enjoy, but...
Niall,
stop it.
Every time.
Schrader. Oh, yeah. Paul Schrader, closing film.
Yes, Dog Eat Dog. We're reuniting him with... Willem Dafoe.
Well, I was a big fan of Light Sleeper.
And Nicolas Cage.
I've nothing else to say to that. Except, where can I buy a ticket now, please? Also, I like the Canyons. I don't care what anybody says.
I do too.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
We're the ones.
The Canyons is not bad.
It's not
bad at all. There's really good things going on.
Yeah.
That's the one with Lindsay Lohan, right?
And James Dean.
It's
and
not great.
I remember James Dean being actually pretty good in it.
Yeah,
he's also
a violent psychopath. So we
it is written
we
by
call
Grady
it Polanski syndrome.
I'm moving on. Also, in we have Neruda, the new one from Pablo Larraín.
I want to see that.
And, we also have Sweet Dream, which is the new one from Italian director Marco Bellocchio. I saw his last one, Blood of My Blood at Venice, and it is terrible. So my hopes aren't high.
Okay.
Amongst the talking points, this seems to have made up for the lack of Italian talent in the main competition.
Oh!
Yeah.
Hey!
Yeah, because you have Paolo Ferrisi in there as well, which is crazy. Yeah.
So it's interesting. And also they have a nice lineup of shorts, as they always do. So, I think they covered a lot of the bases there.
Not for nothing, but I did a bet on Almodovar and Munji, is it?
Yeah,
16-1 for the Palme d'Or, and they're now 7-1 and 10-1 respectively.
I told you last week that Almodovar was the one to watch for the Palme d'Or.
Yeah,
16-1, they know he's gone right in. It's like...
He's taking your advice.
I did not.
So here's the Scan On Long Odds podcast.
Yeah, get all your money on it. Sell your house. Asterix, we don't advocate selling houses.
No. Though if you talk to Senior Almodovar, he may be able to give you some advice on what to do with your
money. Topical.
We leave the news there and we move on to the top 10.
Oh, my stars.
Yes. This is probably one of the most interesting top 10s we've had
ever. It is bizarre.
It is quite strange, isn't it?
Isn't it? It looks like somebody just picked names out of a hat.
Well, let's...
Let's dive in then, shall we?
We probably oversold it now, but so well.
No, but there are some familiar names, some expected titles still in there.
Some.
All right, go ahead.
At 10, Kung Fu Panda 3. So 6 weeks in the charts.
A million quid. Everybody's a winner. It's animation.
Yeah.
Paul.
Yep.
Aw. And little Paul's.
Yeah. Who doesn't like to see baby pandas? I mean,
I don't like pandas, but I guess the definition.
Jay likes nothing. Well, he doesn't like pandas. How do you feel about panda
conservation? The idea that basically the amount of money and energy that we spend trying to save pandas who
that can't save themselves.
Who literally
it's a waste of money.
I don't know. I'd say Jay probably find more whatever about panda conservation, I'd say Jay find more value in panda flavoured conserve.
Tell me about your encounter with a panda.
I killed a thing I love. Sorry, Tropic Thunder is always relevant.
It's fine.
Werner, we discussed this before. Leave the pandas alone.
Could you imagine if Werner Herzog had turned up in Tropic Thunder? That would have just made the best movie ever.
Or Kung Fu Panda 3.
Yeah.
At 9, Roberto Devereaux, the new Met Opera.
These creep in every once in a while, and it's always fun to watch Jay get apoplectic.
I don't understand it. Like, I understand
opera.
I understand that some people like opera, right? I understand the concept.
Careful, that's a big leap.
People like art that is not cinema, right? I'm fine with that.
But why is it in cinema?
Why is it in the cinema?
Why
and how did
it
make 21 grand?
Yeah. It's a night out.
Yeah.
Oh, for the love of God.
Like, you're not going to buy tickets to the opera. It's a nice night out that seems cultured. It's
buy tickets to the opera. Get out of cinema.
Get the hell out of my cinema.
This is the Met Opera. Exactly.
It means nothing to me.
You have to leave the country to go see them.
Yeah.
Well, get to Vienna then.
Okay, everybody can head to Vienna to see the opera. So
exactly.
This isn't
Mission Impossible 5, Jay.
It's not even Quantum of Solace.
The worst Mission Impossible ever.
It would have been a lot more money if it was Mission Impossible 5.
Yeah, I know.
Well, to be fair, it did make 21 grand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
not 1 cent of mine. I hasten to add.
So, in case listeners were curious, and hadn't picked it up.
Aren't sure?
I can understand some of the bigger operas doing really well, so I can understand someone wanting to go see Aida or whatever. But
Roberto Devereaux is not exactly
a household name.
Nothing to sing about,
He's striking a falsetto note over there.
Oh. Hey! Nice. And you sing. You thought he wasn't.
Music
cultured.
To my ears.
God, yeah. Please.
At 8 is...
You're really Mikado-ing that one. Sorry.
Please stop. At 8 is Criminal. Much like Darren's jokes.
Yay! That time someone said it.
You're all thinking it. Sorry, no, we weren't there.
Sorry, did anyone see this?
I know.
Some
it made more than Roberto Devereaux, that's all I can tell you. Although not much more.
How is a movie in which Ryan Reynolds is placed inside Kevin Costner's head a marketable film?
What? Is that what it is?
That's the basic premise of the film. I understand it. Now, I may be wrong here.
That is the
I want to see that movie. I don't care if it's real.
That is the basic idea, but... I've seen this conversation crop up a few times, right? This is a film that has been marketed on its stars. Kevin Costner, Gary Oldman, Tommy Lee Jones, Gal Gadot. Not Ryan Reynolds.
You have
He's not on the
posters. Deadpool and Wonder Woman in the one film. How did this not make a lot more money?
Easy answer. It's supposed to be crap.
Yeah.
Again, it's a movie where you put Ryan Reynolds inside Kevin Costner's head.
How does
it improve
this
either?
This is being Kevin Costner.
You take away the best selling point of Ryan Reynolds, the fact that he's a very handsome man.
Which is the opposite of that when he made Selfies, in which they put Ben Kingsley in Ryan Reynolds.
What Deadpool the hell is you this?
Ryan Reynolds,
I feel like
the Russian
alternative universe.
Yeah. Ryan Reynolds, the Russian nesting doll of actors.
So what you're saying is there's a Ben Kingsley inside Ryan Reynolds inside Kevin Costner.
Now that is a film.
I want to know is
inside Nicolas Cage.
The film, though, is directed by Ariel Vroman.
He did The Iceman.
He did The Iceman. I really liked
The Iceman. Was great. The Iceman's okay.
I threatened to watch The Iceman on many occasions. I've yet to do it.
I suspect I know what you'll think of it. But
it had a nice sort of late night television feel to it, like Things to Remember When You're Dead.
The picture looked like that. It looked cheap and knock-off-y.
It has Michael.
You said
that
like it's a bad
movie. I know.
Who is easily the best thing about it?
Chris Pine is actually not bad. Chris Evans, sorry.
Don't mess up your
Chris. I got my Chris's met. I got crisscrossed.
I was explaining this to the age of the day because I was saying that the next Avengers film is going to have Chris Pine, Chris Evans, or Chris Evans, Chris Pratt.
Four white blonde guys named Chris. Marvel's casting diverse.
You know, whatever about how generic the characters are, but your actors, good grief.
Yeah, that's why Ryan Reynolds had such difficulty becoming a superhero. If he changed his name to Chris, he'd be fine.
No, once he became Deadpool, once you couldn't see him anymore, it worked out apparently.
So this is the logic behind Criminal, is it?
Except I can think of one Chris who's looking at all that and going, wow, amateur.
Right, let's move on to the next one. So I'm curious to the hell.
Yeah, I have no idea what the hell this is.
This was in a great comic book movie. So
yeah, it's all right.
At seven... And this is the one that really perplexes me. Pitbull Nelly Porzatski.
What is this?
This is a Polish thriller.
Oh, okay.
And would you believe it, cinema has actually figured out that countries like the UK and Ireland have a significant Polish minority. And they decided, let's put a Polish film in.
They do a lot of, Cineworld do a lot of Indian films.
Hollywood. But we've never seen, we see them get into top 10 on occasion.
Yeah.
But Polish films, they haven't happened along so much, but
That was like 30 grand.
Second
biggest average of the week.
Our good friend Mr. Donald Clark said that it's not very good.
Okay.
Extravagantly horrid Polish crime thriller. So,
well, you know, we can hope for better next time.
He was very pit bullish about it, if you ask me.
Yeah. I don't think anybody did.
No, but it's playing at a number of audiences. So.
Okay.
Number six. Sing Street.
So Sing Street never heard of it.
Is creeping up on the million euro mark, which is,
very good, yeah.
It'll pass it next week.
Good for them.
Indeed.
Grand, feel good film.
Yeah,
very pleasant.
Very enjoyable.
Yeah. What?
I'm not
saying that like it's a bad thing, like being a pleasant and enjoyable.
It very often is.
The day the soundtrack was released, I downloaded it. It was on Spotify, so I was listening to it.
It has a great soundtrack.
As soon as it was released, because it's fantastic songs.
And it's a lifter-upper.
It is everything that Jay is not.
Cheerful, joyous.
Encapsulated.
Toe-tapping. Tap your toes, Jay. Prove him wrong.
No.
So yeah, you're right.
He's not wrong.
At five, dropping like a stone, is Huntsman's Winter War.
Now we're talking. Now we're to the meat of it.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Down 56%.
It's getting a bit of a cold reception, eh?
Yeah, this is not going to make Snow White vs. the Huntsman money.
Yeah, because nobody cares about this one. Yeah. Even though I'm not sure many care.
To be blunt, it sucks.
I hope they get Chastainized for it.
Oh, good lord.
Oh, no.
Please move on now, quickly.
At four.
you're Theron there.
Biggest drop of the week, 59%. It is Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice.
I don't think they'll be with 2.7 million.
I think they will.
Well, this is the thing, right? We live in a world where a film can make almost $1 billion. So what, 800 million, closing
plus,
on 900.
But is it psychologically
considered a failure?
Yeah, but sure, Age of Ultron was considered a failure and it made more than $1 billion.
Yeah, but isn't this considered a failure because the failure of a filmmaker making it?
Hi-o.
The one that they've entrusted with the next two.
Yeah, I hope someday you meet him. I really do.
Him and Cameron, a baseball bat, one room.
Are you kidding?
See, this is why Irish sports stores sell baseball bats.
But I'm very opportunity.
I've met him and he's a very pleasant man.
Who?
Zack Snyder, I interviewed him.
I imagine he is. Yeah.
Was he in his Nazi uniform or was he?
I was enjoying Mark Kermode's impression of him.
He was after a Sucker Punch.
How did you make this film with your eyes closed?
That interview went an awful lot about asking about his inspiration for the film and not anything at all about the film because the film is dreadful.
I still think Batman Superman is interesting. I would say it's good.
To see the extended cut, because I would, as you were saying during the week, I would quite like to see the 4-hour extended cut just to see what the hell is in there.
I would die before I see it. And I'm not even kidding.
I think we know we're getting Jay for Christmas.
Yeah. Yay! Euthanasia?
What's wrong with young Chinese people?
Silent green is people.
Yeah. Yes, like, well, let's get past Batman, please.
Never get past Batman. But anyway.
But they are going to make a Batman solo movie with Ben Affleck.
Yeah. So.
Written, directed, produced by, starring, catered by, music by...
Dennis Warren.
Yeah.
Rise the Fiend 2, sing the Fiend 2.
Exactly.
Hashtag ZZZZZ.
Speaking of ZZZZ, Zootropolis is actually...
As if I didn't line that up.
Best segue of the week. Right there.
Yeah, I haven't seen this, heard it's good.
Yeah, it's grand.
It'll.
It's not as good as everybody says it is. But
okay.
It's that problem that once you associate the actual what the animals are like in real life with the film,
once you accept its metaphor as what it intends its metaphor to be, it becomes a lot more problematic.
Foxes eat bunnies. Yes. Shock horror.
Yes, which becomes problematic when you want to do a metaphor for race in American culture.
I'm saying nothing.
Yeah. We're going down the whole... I'm going to say, if you went down the whole foxes in thing, watch The Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yes, the best fox movie.
Best fox movie and the best movie about foxes.
Here, put on this bandit hat.
Why didn't I get a bandit hat? I want a bandit hat. Where's my bandit hat?
Controversially, I think that's the point at which I really started to consistently like Wes Anderson. Like, I liked Rushmore. I thought Rushmore was great. I was sort of lukewarm on all the stuff in between The Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic, stuff like that, and then this is Darren being populist, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Moonrise Kingdom, and obviously the Grand Budapest
Hotel. Why don't you wind my wife up, make her watch one of his films?
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
He's such a that filmmaker.
Do you know what? For little Andrew's birthday, I think we should invest in the bandit.
Yeah.
Don't tell her where it's from. Yeah. At 2. Straight in at 2. Eye in the Sky.
Brilliant. I'm delighted with this.
Really
like because
it.
It's really good.
It is.
It's
a bit heavy-handed in places, I think. But
only a couple of times. Other than that, I think it's very... Well, it's solidly made.
Better than Good Kill?
Shockingly,
wouldn't be hard. This is a smart little film,
and
bolstered
it's
by number one, great cast. The last on-screen role for the late lamented Alan Rickman, who brings his standard droll deadpan to some. See, he adds some great moments of levity. Also, Helen Mirren, Barkhad Abdi, and Aaron Paul, amongst others. Also, a rare recognisable role for Jeremy Northam and Ian Glenn. Remember them?
Oh, Jesus, yeah. Oh my God, it's a flashback.
I know. But script's big selling point there, which in a joint US-UK drone operation is entirely held up by the fate of one little girl caught in the crossfire.
Yeah.
It's okay. Riveting to watch.
It's great to watch. I think it's a bit heavy. I do think it's a bit awkward in places.
That,
I think it's,
you have to give maybe the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But even then, it's got as far,
fantastic cast.
As far as mawkishness goes, it's got nothing on Good Kill.
Oh, yes.
Good God.
So
it's horrible.
Yeah.
I say watch this as an
okay.
antidote.
Okay.
It's good
enough. At number one, then, and by a long, long distance, is Disney's The Jungle Book.
This seems to be the ultimate beneficiary of Batman vs. Superman's demise. It has done gangbusters.
It's got great
business.
Reviews, though.
Yeah.
That has helped.
It's pretty much across the board. People like it a lot.
It's hit demographics everywhere.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
One of those special films that everybody is seeing.
Yeah.
So your money making is...
Again, coming at the right time, right
yeah.
after Batman vs.
Yeah.
Superman, but before Captain America. It's like a sublime hold-all.
Yeah, but it's a little palate cleanser in there.
Yeah.
And Disney lining up
yeah.
for Disney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, somebody's earned a paycheck there.
It's quite crazy. I mean, that's the thing. Jon Favreau makes very family-friendly films.
He does.
And they're solid.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I know.
He's the new Ron Howard. That's
terrible. Chef is terrible.
It's not bad.
It's terrible.
It
oh,
will
God.
Make you so hungry.
That is,
but that is not so anything to do with the filmmaking.
And he seems pleasant. He seems like
I don't mind him. I like him.
The thing about Chef was Jon Favreau cast himself in a role where his ex-wife...
Yeah, it's bullshit.
Oh, and he's currently hooked up with Scarlett.
Yeah, his ex-wife is somebody of a guy that he's currently hooked up with Scarlett.
Which film is the nonsense?
It's just mad. Well,
we are living in a world where Ben Affleck is writing, directing, producing and starring in his own Batman film. I think that, I think we can allow Jon Favreau... His ex-wife Sophie Vargas.
They can pretty much allow him to do anything because his film's making money. So.
Yeah, he's writing checks all left, right.
So I don't think anybody's taking that off. Good on him.
It puts incredible pressure on Andy Serkis's Jungle Book, does it?
Well, they put it back, haven't they?
I know. Yeah, it's going to be 2018 now. But
yeah.
Wow.
But it's enough time though.
They're already in works on Jungle Book 2.
Oh, look!
There goes Andy Serkis's Jungle Book.
They really should get that out just before it is that's released. Though. I'd rush them. I wouldn't bother about the quality. I'd get it out a month before it is.
It's just Christopher Walken in a monkey suit.
Okay,
boo.
Hey, how I'll be like you.
You. I'm going to be you, man. Oh, that's how we end the top 10, isn't it?
That's the end of the top 10. Anyway, back to movie news, or this is TV news. Neil Jordan is making a new TV series.
This sounds awful.
For Sky.
I read this today.
For Sky,
Jay, Eternal Optimist.
Do you remember the Good Thief?
Yes,
the
Jordan
film and Nick Nolte.
I didn't mind it.
It's okay.
Good fun.
But I had Nolte, and it was a little. This sounds like a lighter version of this, which sounds abysmal.
What is this just coming in? Tell us more.
So John Banville is involved as well.
Based on an idea by Paul McGuinness.
The former U2 manager. Starring,
do you remember when Bono wrote the Wim Wenders movie?
Yeah.
Starring Julia Stiles.
Bless her, but she hasn't exactly had a quality run of films.
Yeah, and it's called Riviera. It's going to be set in South France. So he gets to decamp to South France and film for a while, and Sky Atlantic is...
But he's not even directing, he's hiring somebody else.
He's just producing.
It sounds appalling. Sorry. Neil Jordan. It's been a long time since Neil Jordan...
I'll repeat my previous statement.
It's been a long time since Neil Jordan's been involved in something really good.
And then it's just silence.
But for what he's made, you kind of just...
Are you getting the I love Neil Jordan.
Come on, lads.
It's the feminist vampire movie. It's the anti-twilight.
Yeah, but it's a feminist vampire movie. No argument. It's a terrible vampire movie. Yes.
I quite enjoy Byzantium.
I haven't seen it. Am I going to have to tie break again and watch it and just make a decision?
No, because it's 2-1, so you don't need to tie break.
I need it.
Right.
Isn't it?
On to new releases, and we start off with Darren. Friend Request.
Is a terrible, terrible film.
I saw the poster at the bus stop and I was like, I took a photograph on it and I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen.
I won't say it's the worst thing I've ever seen. I will say it is not a good thing that I have seen. It is terrible. It's a social media horror, which is a good idea.
But the fun
after Unfriended,
which I've heard is all right.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen it, but I've heard it.
From Facebook in the poster.
And they also use... it's a movie about social networking that doesn't understand how social networking works.
Want to be getting that right.
Yeah, no, but it's not even complicated.
It's the net for social networking.
Yeah, that's pretty much. But it's like the story of it is that a hip, young, cool kid becomes friends with a social outcast on social media. Things escalate. She unfriends her, if you will.
The worst thing you can do, according to this movie, I suppose.
Yeah. And the result is a murderous witch curse. But what's really striking about this is that everybody in the film uses only one social network platform, which is not Facebook, but is Facebook. there's no social media rep. It's a world where adults don't exist. But the problem is that it takes this new age story and it filters it through sort of like classic conventional horror tropes, right? So you have a movie that is nominally about cyberbullying, right?
Mm, okay.
But according to Friend Request, Cyberbullying is most likely to happen when a lone, isolated, weird kid gangs up on a bunch of cool, popular kids with a lavish social network.
No, that's when a group shooting is most likely to happen.
Yeah. There's a point where one of the characters is looking at the Facebook page, goes into the back-end code somehow, and notices... wait,
they hack Facebook.
It gets better. Oh. Notices that the code for this person's Facebook page is written in demonic Sanskrit.
That makes no sense.
I know, and it gets...
But it has to be, it surely has to be just code.
Yeah, it has to be, one would imagine...
Or else it wouldn't be a thing.
One would imagine it would be the same as any other Facebook page, but no.
It has to be written in UTF-8 or something, yeah. Some of the... Yeah, not
UTF-D.
Sanskrit.
Ancient Byzantium.
For fuck's
sake. If they even went in and found all the binary had been replaced by 666 over and over again, that would make more sense.
Wink, smiley face. Lol.
Like, one of the recurring gags, one of the recurring sort of horrors of it is that this woman loses control of her Facebook account, right?
The worst thing in the world.
The worst thing in the world, but she only ever tries to contact Facebook about this once. Like, there's an anonymous demonic source posting videos of people killing themselves on her Facebook page.
You might want to get on top of that.
You might want to call the service center more than once. Yeah. Also, and when they say, we can't do that, you might want to ask for the number of somebody who can, rather than hanging up and beginning investigating a secret demonic cult. Because it really weirdly sort of dovetails into this, you know, like this post-paranormal activity, like everything is a mythic demonic conspiracy, where there's like pregnant women and demonic cults and all this sort of stuff. And you're like, this started as a movie about demon Facebook. Why are they going to an abandoned farmhouse?
If they called the demon baby Facebook, it might have been an easier sell.
Yeah. This sounds like this could be one of those spoof of modern horrors.
But it's
just a tweak in the edit.
But that's the thing. The point is, like, there are moments where you kind of, like, you can see where it's going for that. Where like the adults are not just inept. Like, the film sort of revels in how inept and useless any of the adults are.
That could be good. That idea is actually not bad.
There's a point where she goes to the orphanage where this girl... Where this girl who's demonic cyber-bullying her.
Yeah.
And the administrator, who is walking through the grounds puffing on a cigar like nobody's business, while relating exposition about, like, this poor troubled child, relaying all the information that we wanted to have onto that point. She asks a question that goes, like, this is something the movie's going to tell you in the next 10 minutes. Prompting the administrator to take a puff of the cigar, say, I wouldn't know anything about that, and take another puff of the cigar. It's beautiful.
I always kind of want to see it.
It is terrible. It's terrible.
It sounds almost brilliant and terrible.
And the abandoned farmhouse has Satan written in it in graffiti letters, just
lest
in case
you didn't know. Didn't pick that up.
Yeah. But yeah, no, not a good film. So don't go see that. It's shocking.
It was such a glowing review all the way along.
Moving from the ridiculous to the sublime, right? Louder Than Bombs.
Oh my goodness. We've been waiting for this. Jay and I saw this at ADIF a couple of months back, and we loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, it screened Cannes last year, and so kind of mixed to sniffy
kind of reviews.
Some very sniffy, and I simply can't understand it. We just loved it, and we weren't the only ones. Got very enthusiastic praise from that.
I'm a huge Trier fan on record. Trier, yes, as opposed to Lars Vaughan.
Yeah, this is his English language debut after reprising Oslo August 31st.
And the thing about it is, it's that you hear something like, particularly with an English language debut and the reviews are mixed, you think of something like Sorrentino with This Must Be the Place, that maybe the transition from their own language to the English language can be tricky in the adaptation of source material or whatever, or script. Mm. But so my expectations were lower than perhaps they would have been in general, but I was blown away. I think both myself will probably end up seeing it again at some point in the next week.
I'm going to see it out this weekend. Yeah.
But it's the best film I've seen this year by a long shot. I mean, it's clearly above everything else. And the basic story is
just... It's a clear winner, is it?
Yeah, it is at the moment. But it basically...
Which means you'd probably bomb at the box office, knowing our luck.
Well, it probably won't be. It's a hard one to sell, I think.
It is. It's basically the story of three men who are coping with the path. It's Gabriel Byrne, who plays the father of a family, and his two sons, played by Jesse Eisenberg and newcomer Devin Druitt. And they're dealing with the fallout 3 years on of the death of their wife and mother, played by Isabelle Huppert. And the story is told, it's it's almost like a series of flashbacks tying back and forth in between. It's got a lot of different narrative strands going on.
Even the title will tell you it's fractured. I mean, things have been blown apart and there's bits and pieces. The story is picked up from everywhere.
Yeah.
And from different perspectives. Some scenes are replayed from different perspectives to give clarity to what's happened previously. It's some tone to hilarious effect, by that.
It's true. It's a beautiful jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
It's very impressionistic.
So it's a really, really well put together. The scenes are, like, they're perfectly controlled. This is a filmmaker that this material is familiar. If you've seen, like, you'll have seen films similarly like this, but such as his control of the story he's telling, it feels fresh and it feels a little. The tweak he puts on it, the little slightly stylized things he puts in it to make it work, refreshes well worn kind of ideas.
Yeah, it is a very, very stylish film.
Yeah, very visual.
Very elegant.
Yeah, very, very good. I said to Philip when we came out of film at ADIF that it reminded me of a little bit of the film that beat Rage of Bull the Best Picture.
Oh, Ordinary People.
Ordinary People. And because that's similarly a family torn apart by a tragedy. And the same named character, Conrad, is the son in that film and the son in this one. So I suspect Trier has seen that, or certainly.
He's inspired by it.
Yeah. Because I really liked the film last year. As much as I'd like to hate it, but I can't. But this is superior work. This is as good a filmmaking as I've seen in quite some time, and I can't wait to see it again.
Yeah, and it's a film that needs rewatching. There's a lot going on here.
But which you say it's very easy to watch. It's not like it's not overly complex, but there's just a lot in it. Like there's food for the soul.
Detail everywhere, and it helps that besides that sublime direction and the intelligence that's been poured into the script, the performances. Are top notch as
first
well.
First rate.
Byrne's best film work in a long time.
I mean, it's a reminder, if you ever need one, how good Gabriel Byrne can be with the right material.
Yeah.
He's great. Eisenberg is as good as he's been since Social Network, and probably his best performance. Yeah, it's naturalistic, it's really good. Devon Drew, the young kid in it, is excellent. I think it's the first thing I've seen him in. I'm not sure if he's in anything previous.
Not a lot else, really, but we'll see more.
Yeah, but.
Incidentally, he's a very active presence on Twitter.
Yeah.
Hi, Devon.
This is highly recommended. Go see.
Then also this week, new Miles Davis biopic.
Miles Ahead.
Yeah, directed by Don Cheadle.
Saw this at ADIF as well. Not so hot on this one. This could very easily fall into a kind of a biopic trap, but it's clear from the outset that Don Cheadle, as director and co-screenwriter and lead actor, is not interested in that. So what you get is a film that is roughly half biopic. You know, a lot of scenes of writing up through his career, marriage,
stereotypical stuff. So yeah,
which it can't seem to avoid, and then the other half is kind of like the jazz improv bit, where an older Davis, I have to give credit to him, Cheadle, in a fantastic turn, he completely gets the voice, the look,
the attitude,
bad attitude of the guy. He's a douchebag.
He seems genuinely unpleasant.
Yeah. But he plants that character into a buddy comedy crime caper in which he and a journalist played by Ewan McGregor go to retrieve some stolen masters of recordings for a new album, which have been stolen from him
by
a record producer played by Michael Stuhlbarg.
What?
I'm not making this up.
It's a great solution to the biopic dilemma. They make this up. It's completely
fictional.
What?
If this had been a movie on its own.
What the fuck is this?
Basically. I mean,
it's meant to be jazz, so you improvise around the notes. You take the notes, which are the story of his life. Yeah,
exactly.
This is like the Scatman of jazz biopics.
It's a different direction, I'll grant them.
It is.
You can't say
this. Now, the fact of the matter is, it doesn't work.
No.
Because it's two films smashed together, clearly at odds with each other. And unfortunately, Cheadle has enough skill, enough of an eye, to make me wish that he'd made them separately, because I would have watched one or the other.
Or
I'd,
both.
Yeah, or
but not together.
Not together. Not together. As a double bill, maybe, but not smashed together like this. It's awkward, and it just
sounds,
I don't.
It's extraordinary. It sounds a real misread of
what a
biopic is
meant to
it
be.
It clearly wants to try and capture the
spirit,
the attitude, and the spirit,
which is admirable,
of Davis's work, which is admirable,
but perhaps not the greatest.
It's not this way.
I admire the ambition of trying to do something different with a genre that has basically been reduced to the Dewey Cox story.
Yeah.
This is not the best way.
Wolfhard has killed.
Wolfhard has made it impossible.
Thank goodness. I mean,
although Hank Williams coming up.
Oh, that's in a few weeks.
Can we say though that, whilst the structure of the classic biopic is hammy and kind of cliche, you can take that structure and you can play with that. Like, there's
well,
good
this
biopics.
Is what
they're
trying.
No, but
I
mean,
biopics.
You can take that structure and you can make it work for you if you're a good enough filmmaker. You don't necessarily have to abandon that to do something different, as well.
Yeah, exactly. And this is trying that just doesn't work.
No.
But it has style to spare. Cheadle
is great. He's a fine actor.
He is, and I'm glad that he's getting praise for his performance.
Well, that's good, at least, because I do like
him. And there is genuine investment in the material. Like, it seems like it's not a labor of, like, oh my god, I've got to do this, so how do I do it? It's like, I want to do this, and I want to do this in a way that reflects my experience of Miles Davis.
So he's moved away from kind of the vanity project element of it to some degree.
Well,
but in some way, in the context of trying to do something admirable and kind of worthy of the
thing. The man himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, also, in terms of cast, McGregor is having a bit of fun with the role. He gets to keep his own accent. Michael Stuhlbarg's horribly miscast, but thankfully he's not in very much. But in particular, I'd like to single out Emayatsi Corinaldi, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who plays Frances Taylor, who later becomes Mrs. Davis. And the scenes that she and Cheadle have together, they are the best parts of the film.
They make you yearn for that more traditional
biopic.
Yeah, but that's
what
I'm talking about. Yeah, exactly. And as I said, not wrong with that.
I think
if
Cheadle had made that more traditional film, he probably would have felt like he hadn't done justice to Davis, but it might have been at least more watchable.
He might have done justice to the film, though.
No,
yeah.
I think,
which is the thing.
I think probably as far as the inspirations go, he's looking to something like I'm Not There, which...
But that you have to commit to that completely, though.
That was gutsy.
And you also have to be Todd Haynes.
And you also have to have a lot of different people.
And Cheadle,
a lot of different styles.
Like, Cheadle directed this, right?
He did.
It's just his first film.
It is.
Like, that's ambitious to try and do something like that first time.
Oh,
where Haynes has been honing it kind of thing for quite some time.
Yeah. You can't deny that, one, he loves Davis and his work, and two, he is really striving to do something different.
Yeah.
But the fact it doesn't work, I mean, like you say, it's his first film, so I'm willing to put
a
lot of
God,
some of it down to that, but at the end of the day, I don't know.
It's no friend request, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I think people are going to go into this expecting something. But they're not quite... They're going to get half
Nobody is going to go into this film expecting what they're going to get.
Exactly. They're going to get exactly half of it. What they make of the other half is up to them.
Yeah.
Okay. So, also out this week, Bastille Day.
This
not even released on Bastille Day.
Yeah.
Which seems remarkably stupid, I have to say.
Well, to be fair, it is a French holiday.
Yeah,
but,
I know,
but
you know,
they hate freedom, don't they?
Since Les Mis, there is a fairly, people know when Bastille Day is. So, it's in the cultural context.
Exactly. I mean, either way, you could have marketed it, that's awkward, around it. But it's like another 3 months away, something like that?
In July.
Can't believe the slogan wasn't Bastille Yourself.
Oh my goodness. That actually isn't... I've heard worse.
Yeah,
to be fair.
Better than
the so anyway, it's this is essentially Idris Elba getting his Liam Neeson on, right?
Yeah,
his James
Bond
audition.
The trailer seems to certainly suggest that.
Yeah, I'm just reading the synopsis here. A young artist and former CIA agent embark on an anti-terrorist mission in France.
Of course, they do.
Topical.
Taken, Leon.
there was a more recent Olivier Megaton one as well, wasn't there?
From Paris with Love.
Yes, there we go.
Just add to that slippery of subgenres.
That is the Paris anti-terrorism film.
There's also the one with Kevin Costner in it. Three Days to Kill.
Oh, for the love of God, stop this. Stop this.
And none of which actually star French people.
Leon did, but I started with Leon.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, this looks dreadful.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not. No. But another one that had a troubled production. Jane Got a Gun.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
This was originally Lynn Ramsey, I believe.
It was.
Which was going to be make it very, very interesting.
Yeah. Was Fassbender as well?
Yeah. Fassbender was attached originally, and Natalie Portman. And of those three names you've mentioned, Portman is the only one who's still there.
We've got the kind of the solid, hacky Gavin.
Gavin O'Connor.
Safe as houses.
He did Warrior.
Yeah,
it wasn't Jude Law in as well, and then went Joel Edgerton ended up there.
Joel Edgerton was one of the four screenwriters. Count them, four screenwriters.
There was three on Don Cheadle's Miles Ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
That means four times as many good ideas, right?
Yeah.
And Fassbender was replaced by Ewan McGregor.
Hmm. This sounds problematic. And I like Lynn Ramsey, so yeah. I'm like
The reviews on this one have not been very good.
I am not shocked.
Then,
you're a bit gun-shy.
Opening in the IFI is Mapplethorpe, A Life in Pictures. So this is
about photography. I saw the trailer. It looks interesting enough, actually. I may or may not get to it. Who knows?
Well, apparently he was. I'm not familiar with his work. So.
Nudes, lots.
It's a lot of provocative material.
Yes.
Yeah. And had an affair with Patti Smith.
Indeed.
Well,
amongst others, male and female. Good on him. Double your chances on the Saturday night, I say.
Then last film opening this week is it's opening only in movies in Dundrum and in the SGC in Dungarvan is
very precise
Irish documentary Who is Dermot Murphy?
Well,
so this is based on the noted Irish travel writer Dermot Murphy, who for the last 50 years has gone around the world mostly by bicycle, documenting various far-flung places. It's actually very, very good. It's
why, Niall, is it opening in
only movies? At
well, like the reason it's opening in Dungarvan is because of that relationship down there. But it's difficult for self-distributed Irish films. Movies that are quite good at doing that. IMC will do it as well from time to time. This is directed by Garrett Daly, produced by his wife Martina McLean. And so they gave us a Nightingale Falling, and so they're going down the independent sort of distribution route. And
more power to them, but like you say, that's going to be tricky.
It's niche,
to
mean, I mean.
Yeah, well,
it won't get me at the Dundrum.
Well,
I'm hoping
that it gets enough of a sort of momentum from this release that one of the TV stations will pick it up.
Yeah, which more likely happened.
Yeah. Well, didn't they pick up, one did pick up a Nightingale Falling?
Yeah, the UTV Ireland showed the Nightingale Falling, and they put it in a fairly good time slot as well for it. So
fair enough. Fingers crossed.
Mm. Yep. So that is that concludes our broadcast for this week.
Our broadcast.
Are we going out live?
Oh, good God!
We're bringing
it's severe edits, everybody.
It's going on the wireless.
We back at the Angelus, sure.
Yes. Or alternatively, switch down to our good friends at Radio Luxembourg.
if you want to talk to Philip, his mobile number is
or listen to Longwave Radio Atlantic 252.
All those are the days.
The old days.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.